NRA, you know, there are these 5 million members. Probably there are no more than 10,000 hardcore. They may be multiplying, you know, with the white nationalists are gaining a lot of traction with Trump in power. So that's how the NRA became the largest and most important and powerful white nationalist, legitimate, nonprofit organization. They don't even have to pay taxes. And that's how it has to be seen. Because I hear people waffling saying, well, there are a lot of good people who are members of the NRA. They're not like that. Well, they should leave. Because they aren't a white nationalist organization.
That's Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz. And this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamian. This edition of AR features Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz on guns and white nationalism. The founding of the United States was based on the ideology of white supremacy, the practice of slavery, land theft, and genocide. The mass murder of indigenous people by Euro-colonizers was fueled by white nationalism. From the settler colonialists down to the present, the U.S. has had a long love affair with guns. Violence is driven by racism, patriarchy, misogyny, and homophobia. Worldwide, the U.S. ranks in the top tier in gun killings. From Thousand Oaks to Las Vegas, from Columbine to Sandy Hook, the trail of tears and blood grows. Every massacre is followed by officials ritually saying, "Our thoughts and prayers go out to the victims of this senseless tragedy." A lot of good that's done. The NRA likes to say, "Guns don't kill people, people do." How many more will die before things change? Our guest today is Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz. She's an award-winning historian. She's long been active in the international indigenous movement and is known for her lifelong commitment to social justice issues. She's the author of An Indigenous People's History of the United States and Loaded, her book on U.S. gun culture. She spoke at the International Socialist Organization's annual conference in Chicago. And now, Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz.
In the early 1970s, approximately half of all homes in the United States contained a personal firearm. And nearly a half century later, only a third of households have a firearm. It's actually decreased. However, there are more firearms than population in the United States, in 300 million. There are more firearms in civilian hands than there are people. But only a third of the population even has one firearm. The number of guns privately owned, at the average of each gun owner, is 8 weapons. 8 each. So when someone says, "Yeah, I'll go for self-protection," well, why do you need 8? Especially, you know, if they're AR-15, you need 8 of them, you know. So really there's a gun fetish, a gun hoarding taking place. By the way, U.S. civilians own 50% of the world's privately owned firearms. We're 4% of the world's population. Who are these gun hoarders? So it is significant that 74% of gun owners in the United States are men, and 82% of all gun owners are white, which means that 61% of all adults who own guns are white men. And this demographic accounts for only 31% of the total U.S. population. So, what are the majority of white men so afraid of? Does anyone believe that centuries of racial and economic domination by white men have left no traces in our culture, views, or institutions? So the ongoing influence of this history is compounded by the lack of knowledge and the acknowledgement of the colonists savage violence across the continent that continued until the 20th century, and total colonization of the indigenous peoples, as well as the legacies of legalized racial slavery following emancipation. Gun ownership appears irrational, if not insane, to gun control advocates in most of the world, while gun lovers rely on the Second Amendment because they have no other argument for owning 8 or more firearms and don't wish to admit, perhaps even to themselves, what the Second Amendment signifies. Neither party seems to have any idea of what the Second Amendment was originally about. But I think those hardcore gun owners know very well what it's about and what they're afraid of. This thing about hunting is really a clueless argument that liberals make, and I hope you'll tell all your very sincere gun control advocate friends, don't say you need an AR-15 to shoot a deer. It's embarrassing, because that's not what people get AR-15s for. They do go shoot things, I mean, shoot anything that moves, but that's not what they get them for. And actually, the early British settlers, as well as post-independence rural white settlers, used domesticated animals for food, very little for wild game. Nearly all their hunting was commercial for the huge, lucrative global capitalist fur trade. And mostly they used trapping rather than firearms, taking the skins and leaving the dead animal to rot. Gun use, that's your Daniel Boone, the commercial fur trade. Gun use was neither recreational nor necessary for food. Guns were to kill Indians. The National Rifle Association has around 5 million dues-paying members and many millions more who support the NRA for legislative action and calls for legislative action. Their annual budget is $300 million, only 10% of which goes to direct lobbying. The NRA does very little lobbying. There's no such thing as a gun lobby, really, but rather follows and grades every political candidate, local, state, and federal, on gun rights and puts out a call to their membership to support or campaign against candidates accordingly, focusing on states and local, though not the federal government. And that's where most of the gun laws are made, where gun rights activists tend to focus on Congress relying on federal action rather than fighting where the laws are actually made. So the NRA has active affiliates in many communities, almost every congressional district in the United States, with an average membership as 100,000 per state. The NRA has become, in the past 40 years, a right-wing membership organization with a popular base. So instead of dismissing the Second Amendment as antiquated and irrelevant, or as not actually meaning what it says, which gun advocates, gun rights advocates argue, understanding the original purpose of the Second Amendment is really key to understanding gun culture of the United States and possibly the key to a new consciousness about gun violence. So the Second Amendment of the U.S. Constitution is a simple statement. A well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. So the NRA and its constituency argue that the Second Amendment guarantees the right for every individual to bear arms without regulations, while gun control advocates maintain that the Second Amendment is about states continuing to have their own militias, emphasizing the language of well-regulated. And they say this is manifest in the existence of the National Guard, But that's not the case. The state militias that became the National Guard were already authorized in the Constitution itself. When the amendments were drawn up, there would be no reason to put it in a Bill of Individual Rights when it already existed in the Constitution itself. So the Constitution recognized the existing colonial that became the state militias that later became the National Guard. And during the War for Independence, this was done, you know, this transfer. And they mandated them to play vital roles and to execute the laws of the Union, suppress insurrections, and repel invasions. The President of the United States can always call, as Trump did recently, call on National Guards for federal duty, or like they do, calling National Guard to go to fight their wars in Afghanistan and Iraq. So given now what are descended from state militias, which were repurposed from colonial militias, why was the Second Amendment added as one of the enumerated rights of man in the Bill of Rights? And who were these militias? Well, unequivocally, the Second Amendment, along with the other nine amendments, constituted individual rights. That's what it is. It's a Bill of Individual Rights. And the militias referenced are voluntary and self-organized, not state militias. It's funny to me when liberals argue that somehow the state would have to be involved for it to be well-regulated rather than self-regulated. These settlers had motives for killing Indians and for slave patrols, and that was to take the land. It was in that settler democracy. They were very good at self-organizing to do that. And we all know we self-organize all the time. Maybe not very well, but as well as they do. But human beings do that without the state necessarily being involved. So these are individual liberties. So one argument that runs through the historical accounts of the thinking behind the Second Amendment is idealizing Anglo settler farmers as fiercely independent and fearing Big Brother government, insisting on settlers' right to insurrection, an argument now being taken up even by some anti-racist white groups like the Redneck Revolt and John Brown Gun Club. But what Anglo settlers considered oppressive was any restriction that British authorities put on them in regard to obtaining land and owning slaves. In the instance that's almost always used as an example of this is Bacon's Rebellion in 1676, which is rarely explained as it happened. A very wealthy member of the Virginia colonial government, Nathaniel Bacon, wanted to expand into further into Indian territory and actually got a lot of landless white farmers and some former indentured servants. And at that time, that was just before the racial codes were instituted, there were quite a few freedmen, African-derived indentured servants without land. So he organized them to go in and attack the Indians and take their lands against the colony's wishes, and they got beaten terribly. But their whole goal was to take more Indian land, you know, hardly a valiant pursuit. So they rebelled against their own colonial government to take land for themselves. So what the United States really instituted was the settlers' rights to do that. And then, you know, what happens over and over, then the governments come in, later the corporations too, and they lose that land, the poor losers. I come from my father's family, from these poor losers who from Kentucky, you know, Virginia to Kentucky, then on to Missouri, where Daniel Boone died, by the way. They followed the track of Daniel Boone, and at least some of them, like my father's family, end up in Oklahoma with land taken from Indians and then lose it, and they're tenant farmers. And I grew up, my father was a tenant farmer. And that happened over and over. So they lose it, but they're really foot soldiers of empire. They're being duped all the time because the racial code allows them the white supremacy. They're not afraid of the demographics, they're afraid of the loss of white supremacy. So historian Charles Sellers wrote, quote, cheap land held absolutely under the seaboard market's capitalist conception of property swelled patriarchal honor to heroic dimensions in rural America. The father's authority rested on his legal title to the family land, where European peasant holdings were usually encumbered with obligations to some elite. The American farmer held in fee simple. Supreme in his domain, he was beyond interference by any earthly power. Fee simple land, the augmenting theater of the patriarchal persona, sustained his honor and untrammeled will. The extraordinary independence inflated American farmers' conception of their class far above peasantry. Their aspirate capitalism, not peasants. So the Second Amendment thus reflects this dependence on individual armed men, not just in terms of their right to bear arms, but early on in the colonies, it was a requirement to bear arms. So the violent appropriation of native land by white settlers was seen as an individual right in the Second Amendment, second only to freedom of speech. Male colonial settlers had long formed militias for the purpose of raiding and razing indigenous communities and seizing their lands, resources, and native communities fought back. Virginia, the first colony, forbade any man to travel unless he was, quote, well armed. A few years later, another law required men to take arms with them to work and to attend church or be fined. In 1658, the colony ordered every settler home to have a functioning firearm, and later even provided government loans for those who could not afford to buy a weapon. Similarly, New England colonial governments made laws such as the 1632 requirement that each person have a functioning firearm plus 2 pounds of gunpowder and 10 pounds of bullets. Householders were fined for missing or defective arms and ammunition. No man was to appear in public, a public meeting, including church, unarmed. Were they fighting bears? Who were they afraid of? Who was out there trying to get the land back that had been stolen from them? The Indians. When historians read this, and they disappear the Indians, like, oh, well, they must have needed to kill bears or, something, some predator or something. Oh, one Supreme Court judge said, or maybe Indians. John Stevens, he's the only one that got caught. Maybe they were wanting to protect themselves from the savage Indians. Yes, that was it. So these laws stayed on the books in the earliest colonies and were created in new colonies as they were founded. So the Second Amendment, ratified in 1791, enshrined these rights and obligations as constitutional law. So the continuing significance of what is specified in the Bill of Rights reveals the settler colonial's culture roots, settler colonial democracy, especially after Andrew Jackson, those roots of the United States that appear even in the present as a sacred right. Several of the colonies had declared independence in 1776. Several of those colonies, they all did, the 13. But several of them, Massachusetts, New Hampshire, New Jersey, Pennsylvania, Vermont, and Virginia, already, if you remember your History 101, that they first rebelled as independent sovereign states. Virginia was a commonwealth. Massachusetts was a commonwealth. They each were governments, and they made a confederation of independent states. They had maps mapped all the way to the Pacific, where Maine would be where Salem, Oregon is now, Salem, Massachusetts to Salem, Oregon. They had these maps they had already drawn out to take the continent, but each were separate states, so was what the Constitution did was create the federal government and then states' rights. But several of these colonies, when they declared their independence, actually had the Second Amendment already in their state constitutions. And of course, Thomas Jefferson and Madison of Virginia were the main authors of the constitutional one. So they had already adopted individual gun rights measures in their state constitutions. So they simply transferred it. The reason there's no there's little documentation on the Second Amendment is there was no argument about it. It was just taken for granted. It was not controversial at all that that was settlers' rights. And when compared to other countries, the United States is no more violent than, let's say, the Belgian Congo or Australia, where the Tasmanian indigenous people were hunted as sport until they were all killed off by the British settlers. Horrible, grotesque genocides. The United States is right in there. They don't admit it. You know, Australia's actually apologized, at least, for genocide. We don't admit it. It doesn't get into our textbooks or anything, even with Native resistance. So the conquests in Africa, Asia, the Caribbean, South America, the United States was not exceptional in the sheer amount of violence it imposed to achieve sovereignty over the territories it appropriated. And the British colonizations of Canada, Australia, and New Zealand were equally genocidal, equally settler colonialism. But one thing they didn't have, what did those other countries not have that the United States had? Chattel slavery. Wyoming Senator Alan Simpson, do you all know who he is? Okay. He put it succinctly. Without guns, there would be no West. Adding that his grandfather had settled in the Wyoming Territory 2 years before Custer's defeat by the Sioux and the Cheyenne Nations at Little Bighorn. The West, of course, is a metaphor for the continent as it began on the Atlantic seaboard. But in this interview, Simpson was not only speaking historically about what the guns were for, to kill Indians, always the implied enemy, in order to seize more land, he was promoting gun rights in the present. He pointed out in another interview that in Wyoming, how steady you hold your rifle, that's gun control in Wyoming. So here Simpson reveals when firearms are no longer needed to appropriate indigenous people's lands, the firearm becomes a representation of ongoing colonial genocide and colonial racial domination, a kind of war trophy, like the sports team's mascots or the naming war weapons of war after Indians or operations like killing Osama bin Laden under Obama and naming it Geronimo. Geronimo is dead. That's what they said when they called in to President Obama and Geronimo. So these war trophies, this fetishism, the gun fetish is very related to this fetishism of taking trophies in warfare. So the genealogy of the ascension of constitutional originalism, I don't know, you've probably read some about this, and lately this packing the court, you know, the court will be a great majority of originalists. So originalism means going back and reading, you know, it's like the church I grew up in, the Southern Baptist, that every word is true in the Bible, everything it says. Absolutely you have to figure out exactly what is meant by every word, and there are different interpretations, but you have to get to the original meaning. Well, here we are, you know, then looking back at a bunch of slave owners that wrote a constitution and saying we have to think exactly like they did at the time. Is that right? So a counter-revolution took form after the Supreme Court decision to desegregate schools. They made arguments of states' rights, anti-communism, trying to portray the civil rights movement as communist. And in Oklahoma, where I grew up, rural Oklahoma, signs went up everywhere. Impeach Earl Warren. He was the Supreme Court justice, the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court that decided the desegregation decision of 1953, Brown versus Board of Education. So out of that came very quickly the John Birch Society that organized around impeach Earl Warren. So it was really a counter-revolution that immediately took place with that. I call it an earthquake that happened to white dominance. The civil rights movement, of course, the NAACP was founded in 1901. W.B. Du Bois, he's still alive and you know, working on the court case that was brought that went to the Supreme Court. So it's not as if the civil rights movement just fell from the sky, you know, or they just were being generous. It was very clear there was going to be a revolution in the United States. It was going to build up to that, and not only that, it made the United States look about as bad as apartheid South Africa with Jim Crow. So they had to jump on it, you know, the powers that be, and get ahead of the game and try to fend off the militancy. And of course, Jim Crow didn't just disappear, but there we have to look at that counter-revolution that started at that time. We get confused genealogically because we had this great radical revolution, anti-war movement and black power and red power and everything in the 60s, you know. So it kind of dims the counter-revolution that had already started and just really, really fed off the 60s. Everything we were doing, it was just building up their own until, well, one day Ronald Reagan gets elected to the presidency, and he's very much pushed in the John Birch Society. They started organizing on a very local level, and this is what the NRA started doing too. They called it kitchen table politics, mainly using women, and of course the evangelical movement were, you know, white evangelicals were pulled into this too in the 70s. So the John Birch Society was birthed in 1958 in Massachusetts, but these were very wealthy people, like Fred Koch. You've heard of the Koch brothers. Well, their dad was one of the charter members of the John Birch Society. You know, their white nationalist funding organization now, out of Wichita, Kansas. What they really tried to do is shrink government that would give any kind of reparations or empowerment to the black population, or to Native people, any kind of self-determination, or to Latinos. There was an attitude of reparations, of repairing this, that came out of the 60s movement. But at the same time, these people wanted to shrink government, and that was their idea that, you know, the free market and small government and everything being privatized, that way there would be no public goods to give support for the empowerment of the oppressed peoples, or poor peoples, or trade unions they have attacked too, and they practically have destroyed them.
You're listening to Roxanne Dunbar-Ortiz on Guns and White Nationalism. This is Independent Alternative Radio. You can order copies of this program and the Dunbar-Ortiz book on U.S. gun culture called Loaded by calling 1-800-444-1977. That's 1-800-444-1977. Or you can order online on our website, alternativeradio.org. That's alternativeradio.org. www.whitesupremacy.org.
This highly public reassertion of white supremacy and the Birch Society's methods of founding activist local chapters to first take over school boards and other local offices across the country became a hallmark of the New Right movement. They worked very hard for this. And so this fear of loss of white supremacy was larger than just the white supremacy domestically, but looking around the world, a possible loss of the United States dominance in the Third World. And among the elite, a loss of confidence in capitalism, because almost all of these national liberation movements, I would say all of them, were socialist in their perspective. They were national liberation movements, they were nationalists. But they had, you know, like African socialism. They were socialist-minded. This was terrifying, you know, to the capitalists. And the United States kind of held the reins of the capitalist world. So the National Rifle Association was one of the formations that was transformed during this period. By the time of the 1977 NRA convention, the right-wing Second Amendment Foundation and its lobbying arm, the Citizens Committee for the Right to Keep and Bear Arms, which were founded in Washington State in 1974, they seized leadership in the NRA. And the person in charge was a man named Harlan Carter. As a youth, he had killed a fellow teenager who was a Mexican and was sentenced to 3 years in prison. It was overturned after that, but he aspired to kill more Mexicans, so he joined the Border Patrol, and he became the head of it. And he was the one that instrumentalized and made happen a national program called Operation Wetback. Have you heard of Operation Wetback? That's the slur term. That's the N-word for Mexicans. Wetback, you know, they swim across the Rio Grande River. And that's what it was called. Legislatively, it was called Operation Wetback. This was a violent, corrupt, racist, and massive roundup deportation of people who were allegedly undocumented Mexicans, most of whom were citizens of the United States. And this is the man that took over the NRA and made it a white nationalist organization with the core of it. But still today, you know, there are these 5 million members. Probably there are no more than 10,000 hardcore. They may be multiplying, you know, as the white nationalists are gaining a lot of traction with Trump in power. So that's how the NRA became the largest and most important and powerful white nationalist legitimate nonprofit organization. They don't even have to pay taxes. And that's how it has to be seen. Because I hear people waffling saying, well, there are a lot of good people who are members of the NRA. They're not like that. Well, they should leave. Because they are in a white nationalist organization. Have an unhealthy relationship with the Constitution in this country because most countries in the world don't have constitutions, or they have 10 or 15. Bolivia just did a new one that gave Mother Earth rights, equal rights with human beings. Canada just got one a few years ago. So, you know, it's not sacred. It's not a sacred document. We've got to decolonize the Constitution, and that includes the Second Amendment. You know, these are not God-given rights. These are things that human beings create. Mm-hmm. So we have to desacralize the Constitution, and I think that's this obsession, and it has to become a part of our socialist project to understand that and not fall into the entrapment of this cultish attitude of what the United States is this exceptional God-given power. And I think, you know, it's so embedded in all of us that we have to wash it out, you know, and deal with it and face it and not just repeat it. And slavery was enshrined in the Constitution. So how could it be perfect from the beginning? And you can't, you know, I think it's a structural problem. I think we've almost played out with the greatest effort in the last 50 years to make the Constitution a living Constitution, to work for the people, and it hasn't worked out that way. That didn't work. That's what every, you know, it has been the dream. You know, we can make that ours. And we can't, because it was made for a different purpose. So we really have to deconstruct the United States. Really deconstruct everything about U.S. history.
I don't really think that, you know, saying gun control or eliminate guns is a viable solution. I think that it's just the easy thing for liberals and some progressives to say, but without any real action. And then when you think about the Ronald Reagan case in California, they quickly legislated gun control because they didn't want minorities to have guns. And so if we said every U.S. citizen should have the right to act out their Second Amendment right, then every citizen in the U.S. should have a gun again. And I think that that's the way to go about it, to see if that fight will win or if it, you know, gun control will actually become a topic on the table for discussion.
Well, I agree with you that gun control is not going to go anywhere without a consciousness of where the violence comes from. Why is it the United States is so different from any other place in the world? You know, in war-torn countries, there is not as many civilians with owning guns. So I don't think more guns are the answer to the gun problem. Only 30% of the population, this means everyone, you know, they do not own guns. So it is a minority issue of people who want to own guns. So why increase it?
So I don't think that they would increase it if you make the argument that everyone should be able to enact the Second Amendment right.
Well, let me explain that this Second Amendment wasn't made for you and me. It was made for white settlers. And every time any group has tried to get armed, like the Black Panthers, the lesson to take from the Black Panthers, they were criminalized. They all ended up in prison or dead. And once you're a felon or dead, you don't have Second Amendment rights or constitutional rights. So they criminalize you. It's not made for you and me. You know, no revolution in the world has ever been made that's constitutionally provided for.
Why do you think white people are afraid to let go of the illusion of white supremacy?
Mm-hmm. That's the question, isn't it? It's a good question. I've been studying it all my life, even in my own family, you know, from the settler side of my family. I wrote a whole book on it called Red Dirt Growing Up Okie, because I grew up in this gun culture and evangelical culture. I don't meet many people on the left, never have, who grew up only, you know, really Native Americans and African Americans, but white people that grew up in and knowing this. So it's kind of a unfamiliar, as if all that country out there is foreign territory to people in New York or Chicago or San Francisco or Los Angeles. It's like, who are these people, you know, the deplorables? And they're white settlers. They think they're the victims. I mean, this resentment of being the losers of empire, but that they didn't get land. So my father, these tenant farm people who became tenant farmers, who were the losers, I call them the losers of empire that ended up in Oklahoma taking the last Indian territory that hadn't been taken. It's called Indian Territory. It was supposed to be forever. That's where they relocated Native people from around the country and said, this will always be Indian Territory, forever and ever. But then they opened it up to, you know, to white settlement. And so all of these losers who didn't, you know, who didn't get land and didn't and real estate also included slaves. Up until the Civil War, if you didn't own a slave or some slaves, you couldn't compete with the plantation owners. Yeah, and all U.S. agriculture from the beginning has been cash crop, not little family farms. There's no such thing. They're raising soybeans. They're raising cash crops. They're not raising, I mean, except these little farms that are popping up now, you know, for farmers markets and stuff. So, I mean, in California, they incarcerated all the small farm, the Japanese farmers, Japanese-American farmers who had small plots, put them in concentration camps, and agribusiness took over in the Central Valley. And, you know, it was, that's how they read out, you know, real subsistence farmers, what called truck farmers, farmers markets farmers. So the land has always been commercialized when it's been taken from, you know, from native people who were farmers and who did subsistence farming. So this consciousness of white supremacy is essential to the identity of what the United States is. This was their creation. They created a white republic on the backs of enslaved Africans, on the land stolen from Indians, on taking half of Mexico and making Mexicans into farm laborers, on the Asian exclusion and then Asian exploitation, Chinese especially. But it was created and owned by them. Up until 1950, this country was locked down white republic. Jim Crow, Indians colonized on reservations, Mexicans under Operation Wetback without any security whatsoever, Chinese in, you know, in segregated areas and the West Coast, with socialists, Jack London and others, condemning Asian immigration because it competed, you know, with white workers. So it was nailed down, and then this Supreme Court decision, it's just like, you know, it blew everything up. It was a shock that they haven't gotten over, because I think we don't understand how white this republic was run. Everything was white men. Everything by 1950. Think of it. Everything changed.
I'm from North Carolina, and for me, it does feel like an obsession. It feels like a unique obsession and relationship that the South has with guns, but I also realize that everything I've ever been told about guns and the history of guns is a lie. So I think that that's one of those myths that could be perpetuated, but I also could see that the South's unique relationship with slavery could also, like the legacy that that has, could also impact the way that the South deals with guns. Eventually, I imagine that the way that we as Americans interact with guns is going to be different than it is now. It's hard to imagine that there could be any more guns than there currently are. But do you think that it will, you're talking about a shift of consciousness, do you think that that will be region specific?
The most important thing that's come out of the slave regime were the slave patrols. Guy give evidence of a direct genealogy to police forces. So you have police trained, and it's not like they train them, you go shoot black men. It's that it's in the, it's almost in the cultural DNA of the police, descended from slave patrol, that any loose young African American is a fugitive slave. That's what slave patrols were for. And that's not right. They must be illegitimate. You know, it's in the mindset of police forces. There's a police culture that gets passed down. And the tragedy, and not much has been said because we're all very sympathetic with the Irish famine refugees who came. And of course, they were colonized people too. But colonized people are used to oppress other colonized people, as we know, like Israel. That does happen, and the Irish were desperate and poor, and they could only get the lowest jobs, and they were often recruited to slave patrols in the Cotton Kingdom. And so a lot of Irish became policemen, you know. I mean, there's an ethnic aspect to it, too, that's never really been looked at. It's kind of a sensitive thing, but I think it really needs to be looked at. And what I mean by consciousness is what we're doing here. I think no one is going to do this if we don't. If socialists and leftists don't bring these issues up, who else is going to do it? I've heard in the past, we've got to go easy with people and not tell them the whole thing. Well, I see now that I think that that was a ruse, that they didn't know it themselves, you know, or didn't acknowledge the history themselves. And we have to, we're no longer at the point that we can waste our energy on slowness, you know, or holding back information. I think we have to be blunt. And that's, I think, with these young people, that's how I organize young people in Oklahoma. I tell you, they feel liberated when they get out of this mindset. They're unhappy people. What are they, all opium addicts now, you know? They're unhappy people. We have, think of it as a missionary effort, rescuing the children of the settlers.
I think the point that you talk about, the deification of the Constitution, I think is really important for us to obviously challenge in thinking about the U.S. empire and everything. And so I think it's important for us to actually counter that and say, yeah, you know, guns were absolutely critical both now to the U.S. State and U.S. empire, as well as in the past.
Okay. So I don't actually have much of a question. It's sparked a thought that I've been having in my everyday life. So we can all agree that our media is important. I can certainly say that there is a media specifically for these like gun fetishist racists. I work in an independently owned used bookstore, and I can clearly say that there's a huge market for these people, and it's westerns and military fiction. Because these things, they fan the flames of white supremacy and also misogyny. Have you seen the cover of Western novels? But if I had a nickel for every time an old white guy gave me with a handful of old Louis L'Amour paperbacks, gave me a funny look at the cash register for wearing my Black Lives Matter shirt, if I had a nickel for every time that happened to me, I wouldn't be scraping the bottom of my wallet every month.
You know, I want to throw out this question because I think you bring up this point about the Second Amendment was never for us. But I would say, like, you know, the First Amendment about free speech, the Fourth Amendment about search and seizures, those are all impracticable under capitalism. Law in the society is shaped by the ruling powers of society. I guess my question is, I would argue that the First and the Fourth are still necessary to defend as rights, even if this Constitution isn't ours. So I'm just wondering about the Second Amendment and how important that is to actually defend the world, even though all the limitations, like, we still need to defend, you know, the rights on paper that exist.
Changes the way one understands the Second Amendment to understand its roots to the beginning of the colonial settler project. Is it not also the case that the entire Bill of Rights was a concession granted by the upper orders in the new republic to entice the lower orders, which retained some self-organization and some power from the War of Independence?
Well, from the whole colonial era. Settler colonialism wasn't like English peasantry or French peasantry. These were individual settlers who came to be kings, not to be peasants, not to be ordinary people. That's why the White Republic erases class. Class doesn't exist in the United States. Everyone has equal opportunity. But see, for white people who don't make it, how humiliating that is, because it's their republic. And they're the losers, so they have to find someone to blame for that. Because it's their republic. They have failed. They blame themselves. it really shouldn't be that how the Irish became white, how the Jews became white, how Italians became white. It's how they become settlers. Because you have a choice as an immigrant when you come to the United States, or when you go to Israel, or when you go to Canada. Are you going to be a settler? Are you going to be with the people? Are you going to fit into the U.S. narrative, find your place there? You know what you have to do that? You have to hate black people. You have to hate Mexicans. And so immigrants learn that to survive or to do well. So people become settlers. They adopt the settler mentality because American nationalism, U.S. American nationalism, is really white nationalism. The narrative of U.S. nationalism that some of you are repeating here by using the rhetoric of the defiant settler that wanted their individual rights, that the upper classes. No, the settlers were completely involved in the project. There couldn't have been this powerful republic without the use of these dupes. They were dupes. You know, I call them dupes, not don't stop romanticizing them. It's something that native people in this country have raised that is so important. And I find these days the only way I can explain it, U.S. history and settler colonials, and say, well, you know Israel, how it is there, the Palestinians. Well, they copied the United States. You know, they based their entire project on the U.S. reservation system, reduce people to little, you know, settler colonialism, surround them until they no longer exist literally. It's genocidal. And, I mean, to have to refer to something that started in 1948 to tell U.S. history, there's something perverse about that. If we're not getting it about the United States and we keep repeating these romantic stories about the possibilities of the Constitution. In Britain, in Europe, you can be penalized for race speech, criminally penalized for pro-Nazi hate speech. It's international law and the Treaty on Racism against Racism and Apartheid. So are they less free in Britain to speak? Because they don't have the First Amendment? I mean, this cultiness around having to have those things in order to be free and fighting for them instead of fighting liberation fights, you know, trying to hang on to this. So it's like Samir Amin says, you know, it's very hard to let go of something so deeply embedded in you. It's hard for Europeans too to let go of Eurocentrism, to let go of settler colonialism. And because it's comforting, you know, you think there's something there, there's some hope there.
You were just listening to Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz on guns and white nationalism. She spoke in Chicago. Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz is a preeminent historian. She's been active in the international indigenous movement for many decades and is known for her lifelong commitment to social justice issues. She's the author of many books, including Loaded, her book on U.S. gun culture. This program is produced by Alternative Radio based in Boulder, Colorado. We are independent and part of the nonprofit organization Rise Up. We are supported solely by individuals just like you. We feature progressive voices from Chris Hedges to Naomi Klein. And we have a series of Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz programs. To access our complete audio and book catalog, just go to our website, alternativeradio.org. Again, our website where we are podcasting, alternativeradio.org. To place a credit card order for CDs, MP3s, or written transcripts of today's program, Roxanne Dunbar-Ortiz on Guns and White Nationalism, and her book on U.S. gun culture called Loaded, call us at 1-800-444-1977. Again, that number is 1-800-444-1977. Or you can order on our website, alternativeradio.org. Joe Ritchie is our general manager and editor. I'm David Barsamian. Thank you for listening.